Okay, hello, Ultras. Welcome to Take Two, which also comes to you from Upper Street, the sleazy end of North London's Islington Parish. Thank you very much for subscribing. We're at the Union Chapel. Those in the audience, you're basically getting this extra ultra mega bonus content for free, although you will be fleeced on your way out. There's a Dodge Brothers CD stall. Would that be right?
Yeah.
This email from Ian in London, first-time correspondent but heritage listener. Are there any heritage listeners in the house, by the way? Just checking. Simon and Mark, I'm listening to Take Two and wondered if Mark could explain further, even if only in a single line, why he thinks the notion of the three-act structure is, quote, rubbish. This is a reference to last week. There are several books breaking down screenplays and novels this way. The one I've read most recently is John York's excellent Into the Woods, which has helped me plot a story I'm writing. To help with my writing in future, I was curious if slash why Mark thinks it can't be applied at all, or if it works sometimes but shouldn't be used rigidly. Specialist question from Ian in London.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that it doesn't work at all. In fact, you know, Jason Isaacs went on the... Who's the guy, the name of the guy who does the writing structure course? Him. Yeah, Rob McKee, thank you. And Jason went on it and went, you know what, he's right. It's, you know, it actually works. But it works in a certain way, and yet most of the movies that I really love just don't obey it. And I think the problem with saying that there is such a thing as a three-act structure, which is a beginning, a middle, and an end, is, well, there's loads and loads of films that I love that certainly don't have a beginning, a middle, and an end in that order, and quite often don't have that at all. And it's, you know, all the things that surprise you tend to be things that don't obey those rules. It's not to say that they don't. I mean, clearly, there's a massive amount of... If you listen to any pop record, I remember that really clearly there was a moment when somebody pointed out to me, in the 1970s, most pop records were three chords. They were a version of A, D, E, or G, C, D, or E, A, B. That's just... And you suddenly go, oh, I can play every song ever written until you come across a song that you really like and you find it doesn't do any of those things. So that's all it was. It's just I don't particularly like rules.
If you like to... I'm a rebel.
Yeah. Sorry, you're a what?
A rebel.
Why does rebel need to be said in a slightly...
Because I was once in a band at school that were described as rebels without applause.
What was the name of that band?
That was The Basics.
And after The Basics, you went on to...
Fifth Incident.
And then?
Border Incident.
Then?
And then Henry 100, which I did for a while, which was very funny. Then Russians Eat Bambi, which is still my favourite band name. And then The Railtown Bottlers. I can do this all night.
Yeah. And then The Railtown Bottlers, and after that?
The Dodge Brothers.
Which of those bands were the best? Which was the best band?
The Dodge Brothers are the best band I've ever been in.
Okay, just checking. If you want to email us, by the way, correspondence@kermodemayo.com. We're going to do Take It or Leave It, You Decide. So this is the feature where you tell us what's worth bothering with and Mark watches it. It's word of mouth in podcast form. But before we get to that, another email from Richard, whose proposal we read out on the show in this feature 2 weeks ago. We've had proposals on a fairly regular basis over the 21 years.
We have.
And I'm still haunted by one that we read out and then nothing. Complete silence, which you can only assume that the answer was, mm-mm. So, this is Richard in Leeds getting back in touch with the program.
Oh, good.
Ciao, Signori Kermodemayo. Following on from my... Was that laugh because of my Italian accent? I mean, that's quite harsh on the basis of three words.
Do it as Jared Leto. Ciao! In it.
This is Richard in Leeds. It's his proposal, OK?
I'm a proposal. I'm down on my knee. I say, I want you to marry me. In it, no?
I can only apologise to Richard in Leeds at this point. Following on from my heartstopper email, because you asked how it went, I wanted to give you an update.
Yes.
Well, Rob did indeed say yes to my proposal. Yeah! on the top of Monte Baldo overlooking Lake Garda. It was perfect.
Wow.
Then again, as we've been with each other 12 years and own a house together, if he'd said no, the rest of the holiday, not to mention when we got home, would have been orcs, to say the least. Thank you for your congratulations and reading my email. Ecco l'amore, which Google tells me is his to love, but who knows. But Jared Leto would say it.
When the moon hits the sky like a big piece of pie, that's amore, isn't it?
Thank you, Richard in Leeds. And thank you, Jared. The thing is, Jared Leto cannot ever be a guest on the show, can he? He just...
Damn.
It's like if Michael Bay was offered to us as a guest, as he is sometimes. You
just want to go, do you not listen to the programme?
Anyway. So lots of people have recommended this one, including Adam Grossman, Harry Rose and Matt Richards. Also, Vicky Wong, Vicky's email. Dear Mark and Simon and Mark, I've just finished the first episode of your new show and was pleased to hear that you were doing reviews for TV adjacent or cinematic television. I was wondering if either of you were willing to give Apple TV's Pachinko a chance. Based on the novel by Min Jin Lee, it's an epic family saga that covers four generations of a Korean family living in Japan. It's a story about immigration, generational trauma, racism, and the legacy of Japanese colonialism. I was a huge fan of the book, and I watched the show with my husband, who hadn't read it. We were both bowled over by this show, and dare I say it, I think it's almost perfect. On many occasions, my husband and I were reduced to tears. It boasts stellar performances, particularly from newcomer and lead Kim Min-ha, who plays the matriarch in her younger years. In her older years, she's played by the formidable Yoon Yoo-jung, who played the grandmother in Minari. I hope I haven't oversold this show too much. We'll be curious to hear your thoughts about it. All the best from Hong Kong. That's Vicky Wong.
I mean, the best thing about this feature is there's suggestions for things that I didn't even know about because I'm, you know, very ignorant in this area. So I haven't read the 2017 novel, which is indeed a sweeping work of historical fiction going through these, you know, large period of history of Korea, Japan, World War II, Allied occupation, Korean War, economic prosperity, all seen through the prism of one family. So I hadn't read the book, so I knew nothing about the series when I started. Two narratives intertwined at the beginning, some parts set in Japanese-occupied Korea of 1915 at the beginning, another late 80s New York. In the latter thread, a Korean-American businessman who's been passed over for promotion asks to be sent to Japan to close a business deal. He meets his grandmother at that point, played by the brilliant Eugenie, who of course is from Minari, who we then see being raised as a girl in the other part of the narrative, so the narratives are kind of meeting in the middle. It's directed by Kogan Arda and Justin Chun. Kogan Arda made the films Columbus and After Yang, and I know that you'll know After Yang because I've been playing the soundtrack of After Yang by Asuka Matsumiya, who is one of my favorite film composers, on Scala a lot. Justin Chun directed Blue Bayou, which we reviewed a couple of years ago. He's also in the Twilight movies. I knew his name from somewhere, and it was driving me nuts. He's actually in the Twilight movies. So... for me, this kind of is a sweet spot because it's the work of people whose work I already like and admire. It's a subject that I don't know much about, but it is endlessly fascinating. And it is, this term that we've been using, cinematic adjacent TV, it is profoundly cinematic. In the first episode, there's this lovely scene in which the young girl, Sunya, tells this drunken fisherman who has got drunk one evening and been in her house talking about bathing his hands in the blood of the colonial oppressors. And she's the girl who says, you have to move out because we can't have that kind of talking about it because you're endangering my mother and father. And it's one of those kind of great inverted things in which it's the child who's speaking the truth and being the adult while the adults aren't, you know, facing up to it. And all that is very cleverly intercut with the modern day New York narrative, which at first you think, how is this going to work? How are these two parts going to come together? So I've watched the first three. So it's about 3 hours. I love the way it looks. It's a kind of lavish, sweeping period drama of the kind that I haven't seen for a while. It's got real epic scope. You couldn't do it as a film because it needs to have the space to breathe that it's getting from the from the series. The performances are great. There are some really, really touching emotional moments. And it's a great kind of history lesson as well. So, yeah, thank you ever so much for recommending Pachinko to me. I've done 3 episodes. I will now finish the rest of it because it's really, really good.
How many more are there, do you know?
I think there's another 5, I think. But, I mean, okay. I'll just keep watching until it stops.
All right. Vicky Wong, who sent us the recommendation from Hong Kong. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for that recommendation, because it's a terrific, terrific
watch. That's on Apple TV Plus. So, a recommendation for next week. This comes from Jamie. To the Good Doctors, heritage listener and jealous of your live show audience. They're looking very smug, Jamie, I have to say. I've recently come across a possible film-adjacent television program on Prime, and it's called Undone. Has anyone seen Undone?
And? Great. Okay.
What did they say?
Great.
Okay, well, it's a positive start. Jamie continues, this was randomly discovered one quiet night at home, and I absolutely fell in love. It also fits into the recent multiverse discussions with the plot asking whether some mental health conditions are really people with special power specifically to travel to other dimensions. I don't think it adds a lot to the multiverse canon, but it does provide a fascinating lens through which to view the concept. The characters are believable and you find yourself lost in the same confusion, doubt, and soaring hope as they try to change their personal histories. I admit I am particularly drawn as I live in what might be called Counselor's Corner in the church. However, I think there is a lot to love about this and wanted to share my discovery. Hello to Jason, which we haven't actually said. So do you want to say hello to Jason, by the way? It would be a very good thing.
On 3, 1, 2, 3.
Hello, Jason. All right, very good. And Tiggity Tong, Jamie says, and he says, bags is on seats for the next live show. Okay. All right, but you have to pay
okay,
money
so it's
that.
Called?
It's called Undone.
Undone, okay. So, and it is? Thank you.
That's one person in 600 has seen it. Let's see if we can change that.
That's right.
So you're going to watch...
Double its audience overnight.
Yeah, we're going to watch Undone, and it's on Prime. Jamie, thank you very much indeed.
I have to say, of all the features that Simon Poole has come up with, most of which make me want to bang my head on a wall, this is the good one, because I have actually discovered really interesting stuff from people writing, so I'm very grateful.
He's now punching the air. But anyway, I just want to say this to Simon Poole, our showrunner. Arsenal were 5th. So let's do some more with Rory Kinnear. We were speaking to him about his new film, Men, which he stars in alongside Jesse Buckley, just talking about various bits and pieces. Rory, it's nice not to be talking about Men all the time, just because I'm the only one in the room that's seen it, and you're the only one here who's actually in it. Can I just ask you one question about James Bond? And that is, we talked about it so much because it was delayed so much. You must have been very good at keeping secrets, because that film, the details of that film, really did not leak.
It's interesting, because we weren't sat down and given given a 3-line whip as to, you know, to keeping our mouths shut. It was just sort of assumed that we'd be responsible. I mean, there was a break for COVID in which no one really saw or spoke to anyone anyway. So that helped probably keep the secrets. But no, it was remarkable that it didn't manage to leak out.
Particularly the ending?
Yes, particularly the ending. But I mean, maybe not everyone has seen it yet.
At what point can you talk about the ending of the James Bond film? There must... Mark, come on, when...
Like Simon, I was astonished that it hadn't leaked. I mean, particularly since I saw it the day that it opened, and I went, oh, they, wow. And again, I genuinely, if there's anybody who hasn't seen it, I don't want to be the person to spoil that. But there is a question, which is, I am presuming, therefore, that anybody who was in the Daniel Craig series now cannot be in any future Bond movies, because the...
You're saying there's a logic to those films? I think they're meant to be fun, Mark. Except, yeah, Judy provided a sort of a bridge between Piers and...
Yes, but there's a crucial difference about the bridge between Piers and Daniel Craig.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. I understand.
And so, consequently,
In your theory, there should be no more James Bond films.
No, in my theory, if there are any future James Bond films, and believe me, I have lost some sleep about this. Yes. Okay. If there are future James Bond films, they cannot exist in the same universe as the Daniel Craig Bond films.
Another multiverse.
Well, weirdly enough, I have heard people saying, well, actually, the only way that Bond can now is to do multiverse Bond. And so, you know, suddenly we're in the George Lazenby multiverse. But, I mean, I know this sounds ridiculous, and I know I'm over-egging it. I'm going to give one last run at this, because I think there is a serious point. Because this Bond movie has done something that no previous Bond movie has done, it is not possible to import anyone from that world into a future incarnation of Bond.
And thereby, by your logic, I could end up playing Bond himself.
Yes, you could. You could. You could.
And if you thought there was a fuss about when a blonde actor was cast. James Bald.
Sanjeev Bhaskar earlier was wondering whether you can play a musical instrument.
He could have just asked me himself. I can play the piano.
Ooh!
Organ?
Can you play the organ?
I can play the organ. Where do I go?
Is that allowed?
Behind the set.
Am I allowed to play your organ?
No such thing as a cheap laugh.
Anything apart from Raiders of the Lost Ark? This is an exclusive. Sanjeev, here's your answer.
Not very good with the pedals. Should have taken my shoes off. I mean, that's basically all I'm going to play.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, the multi-talented, award-winning Rory Kinnear.
Thank you, Rory.
Thank you. I presume everyone knew that was Bach's Fugue in G.
Although for copyright purposes, it was something he knocked off on the spot, therefore we have the rights to play on the podcast.
Presumably you can play Bach. That's not in copyright now, is it?
It was the Casualty theme tune, so.
But inspired in some way by Bach?
Yeah.
I'm sure I've heard Mark play it.
Which I believe the composer's leaping off point was Paganini's variation. Not Bach.
Yeah. Rory Kinnear, ladies and gentlemen, he is done. He goes. Rory, thank you so
thank you
much. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rory. Okay, that was Rory Kinnear. On to One Frame Back.
It just flew past, didn't it? It was amazing.
But isn't he great?
He was great.
Okay, so this is One Frame Back. We're going to do a Stranger Things special because you reviewed Stranger Things in take one. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a little bit of a dive into the new series. We asked Witter takees for their favourite 80s references from the series. Mm.
Yeah, it's like Fetch. It's just not going to happen, is it?
James Kemp.
Thank you for understanding that joke. Thank you.
What did I like about it? Well, too many to mention. Just love the whole Stephen King, Spielberg vibe. Peter Jameson has written in, hello number 11 and number 8. I am a Heritage listener. Just a reminder, how many Heritage listeners are there here? That's 100% Heritage. And a regular contributor of pithy comments to the show via social media. I think we'll be the judge of that. My take on Stranger Things is when season 4 was delayed by something or other, bereft of his fix, I directed my 10-year-old to Super 8. What a film that is, which is an all intents and purposes, a movie prequel to Stranger Things, which the TV series flagrantly plagiarized. A movie which, of course, he loved, given that Super 8 is effectively an updated reworking of E.T. I would have to say that the best 80s reference in Stranger Things is actually E.T., of course. Definitely not Ghostbusters, which I would imagine takes up 90% of the answers to this question. Cheers and congratulations on the new format, which you should have done years ago. Oh, okay. Thanks a lot. Okay. But that's that is interesting, because Super 8 is such a fantastic film.
It is. I mean, okay, so I think the fascinating... When I was first sold Stranger Things, I was told, look, you'll love this because it's about all the things that you love. So Spielberg, 80s, there was a lot of talk about the Goonies. There was a lot of talk about E.T. and the bikes and the, you know, the kids together. But of course, the audience that it was aiming at, most of them wouldn't have been old enough to have seen... There's a Jaws poster on the wall. They wouldn't have been old enough to see Jaws in the cinema. They probably wouldn't have seen any of those films in the cinema. If they'd seen them, they would have seen them at home on television. And the other thing that was interesting was that when we did that thing on Kermode and Mayo's home entertainment service, it was around the time that, you know, it had been in cinemas and had been technically hailed as the biggest grossing horror movie of all time. I mean, obviously unadjusted for inflation, because in the real world, that's actually The Exorcist. But, well, it just is. I mean, it's not an opinion. It's just, it's a true fact. And there was an argument that somehow what Stranger Things had done was to lay the groundwork for it to become the huge success that it was, because Stranger Things owes this massive debt to Stephen King. So the title Stranger Things, which is a kind of a formation of Needful Things, and the way in which Stranger Things is written is from the original cover of Firestarter. The lettering is from Firestarter. And obviously, I grew up reading Stephen King. I love the Stephen King novels. There's also a lot of Poltergeist in it, which, you know, I know is a Tobe Hooper film, but it's a Tobe Hooper film, you know, by Spielberg as scriptwriter and producer, and there's a lot of argument about whether or not Spielberg is really the auteur behind Poltergeist. There's a lot of Stand By Me, which again is Stephen King doing the kind of writing that you love Stephen King for. And I thought it was fascinating that the Duffer Brothers had come to this because M. Night Shyamalan had liked this thing that they'd made that took 2 or 3 years to get released. And he'd said, okay, I think you're really interesting. Why don't you work on this series that I'm making, Wayward Pines? And as a result of that, they then pitched what was originally Montauk. And they basically pitched it as this sort of retro throwback Spielberg, Stephen King, sweet spot, 80s, Stand By Me, all those things that we've been talking about. So the genius of it was that it never hid any of its hit points. The problem is whether or not it is just like somebody playing a greatest hits record of this is from that, this is from that, this is from that. And I was doing it even when I was reviewing season 4. I was going, well, that bit is, you know, from the second Amityville movie, and that bit is relating to that, and that bit's relating to that. And actually, I think that when it's at its best, Stranger Things, in very much the same way as Super 8, manages to go, okay, we love the same reference points, but we'll do something interesting with them. And I really liked the movie of It. I thought it was really, really good. And I love the TV series. I know you and I both share a kind of, you know, an admiration for Tim Curry as Pennywise, but I think that the film of It did a really, really good job. And I think that...
Hiya, Georgie.
And I think that that's where it fits in, is that it's got all those things on its sleeve, and it is possible to look at it and go, it is just somebody referencing all these things that they love, but it's filtered through a kind of, you know, it is filtered through Super 8, and it is also filtered through the fact that most of those things that they love won't have the same cultural cachet for the target. I said to the good lady professor who indoors, Linda, I said, who do you think the target audience for this is? And she said, well, it's us. Well, we're in our 60s. And it's clearly not. The target audience for Stranger Things is much, much younger than that. So the target audience for Stranger Things probably feel about those 80s references the same way that I did about all the 50s music and the, you know, all those ersatz 50s bands that I loved when I was a kid. You know, I loved Mud, I loved the Rubettes, I loved Shwadi Wadi. They were all playing a form of music that I wasn't even born when it was a hit, but I still felt nostalgic for it. I remember going to see American Graffiti. You know, where were you in 62? I was unborn, that's where I was. So I think it has the same thing, that it's retro nostalgia for people who don't remember it from the first time round.
Did you ever think, I think they've upped the cursing in series four, so you still, sometimes they're hitting that kind of, this is a kids' TV show, the horror level is 15, borderline 18 sometimes.
Is it borderline 18 though?
Well, I don't know, I think
it's solidly 15.
Some high-end 15.
Yeah, but remember that what now constitutes high-end 15, you know, is stuff that probably would have been 18-rated or X-rated back when you and I were young. But nowadays, you can get away with an awful lot in horror cinema as long as what you're not doing is, you know, graphic depictions of prolonged physical distress or sexual violence or anything like that.
No, there's no sexual violence, but there is, you know, there is torture and breaking of limbs and snapping.
There are sequences that call to mind. If any of you have seen that film, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Exorcism of Emily Rose?
Why are you asking me?
Is it called? Because I always confuse it with The Possession of Joel. Is it called The Exorcism of Emily Rose?
Well, let's ask. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, yeah. And you know that thing when she does the contortion and she goes, there's a lot of that in it, which I think works rather well. But I think it's absolutely solidly 15. And I think if it lost that, it would lose its target audience. I think if it was an 18 rated thing, it would sink because it's not. That's not what it's aiming at.
So the idea of One Frame Back is that if you were to recommend one thing that we should then go away and watch as well as and alongside and adjacent to Stranger Things, what would it be?
Well, I'd say go and watch the two modern It iterations. And if you get a chance, watch the original TV series of It, which I know was very flawed, but there were so many things in it that were absolutely brilliant. Absolutely. And Tim Curry, it's one of his...
Hiya, Georgie.
One of his finest performances. You know, and Super 8, probably, because Super 8 is kind of the sump from which it all
comes. I mean,
comes.
This is another discussion, but talking of flawed, the original book by Stephen King has a very problematic sequence in it.
It does, which is not in the film.
Absolutely. It's kind of... There's a nod to it and a reference to it, but if you've read the book, then you definitely
just
look it up. You'll appreciate what we're talking about. But I'm not going to talk about it now. Before we're done, I think we need some more music. Now, for this piece, I would like you to do something a bit special, which you might think is incredibly naff. And it might be that you've been at concerts and you've thought, look at those jerks doing this, I can't... What are they doing? But could you get your mobile phones out? Okay, get out your mobile phone. Can you switch on your phone torches, please? This is going to make Phil Collins at the front here feel right at home. He's going to be singing, Take a Look at Me Now. And most of his greatest hits in just a moment. This is a fantastic sight. I'm quite overcome. It's just like Genesis. Okay. So we're going to hear our last piece of the evening. I think the house light. Can we lose all the other lights other than the torches? Okay. All right.
It's like Christmas.
We're going to hear our last piece of organ music for tonight. And we're going to hear First Step from the fantastic Interstellar soundtrack by Hans Zimmer. Ben at the organ here at Union Chapel. Take it away. Wow. Thank you very much. Ben at the organ at the Union Chapel, Islington, North London. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for coming. That's it from this week's Take Two. Thank you for subscribing. We'll be back with more extra stuff next week. Thank you very much. Good night.
Ben's going to take a bow. Come take a bow.
Ladies and gentlemen, your organist, Ben. Magnificent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. That was fantastic. Thanks very much. We really appreciate you being here. That was fun.
Yeah, how was it? Was it all right?
A round of applause for our production team, please, over here. Also for our sound team, the light team, everyone at Union Chapel. It's Mark Carmo.
Simon Mayo.
Thanks for coming. We'll see you again. Thank you.